The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
From the beginning, I knew this program was going to be controversial. I knew that before it started, that if we went down that road, sooner or later, this would become a huge issue. I did not imagine that it would remain such a third rail in American national security and just straight out politics 5 years after the program was unequivocally and publicly ended. It has had remarkable legs. I mean, I have no doubt, Ben, that. What the first paragraph of my obituary will read. John Rizzo, who approved a controversial CIA program post 9/11 to interrogate suspects that programmed as some many observers remarked as tortured, died today. I'm resigned to it.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 19th, 2014. That was former CIA Acting General Counsel John Rizzo writing his own obituary from Pepperdine University. Rizzo has a new book out. You probably read something about it. I have a review of it up on Lawfare today. The book is called Company Man. I caught up with Rizzo at a conference at Pepperdine earlier this month. We talked about the book. We talked about the persistence of the interrogation controversies. We talked about the endless cycle of the CIA's being asked to do unpleasant things and then held to account for doing them. And yes, we talked about the NSA controversies as seen through the schadenfreude of a CIA lawyer. It's the Lawfare Podcast, Episode 71, A Conversation with John Rizzo.
What made you want to write a book? It's not something that CIA lawyers normally do, and give us a sense of it.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm the first CIA lawyer that's written a memoir of his or her career. And actually, that's one of the reasons I decided to do it. My career, the book is called Company Man, 30 Years of Controversy and Crisis in the CIA. And I decided to write it, I embraced the idea of writing a book shortly after my retirement at the late 2009. In my period there of decompression, my last several years at the agency were quite turbulent with all the controversy over 9/11, post 9/11 actions by the agency. So my first couple, 3 months, I was decompressing, and the thought came to me that of all the CIA memoirs written, all these insider CIA memoirs written, one, there had never been one written by a lawyer, and two, there had never been any written that covered the span of time that encompassed my career. I joined in the wake of the Church Committee hearings in the mid-70s and retired in the wake of the demise of the post 9/11 terrorist interrogation program. With all sorts of controversies honeycombed throughout that career. And it occurred to me that my career actually tracked the modern evolution of the CIA. I came in at the birth of congressional oversight, for instance, and the birth of the executive order governing CIA collection of information on U.S. persons. So I thought it might be a new perspective to use the arc of my career through stories, and that's what the book is, stories, to reflect how the CIA changed, and also reflect how the CIA, frankly, seems destined to be always embroiled in some flap or another. So that's why I thought it would be a useful, if not unprecedented, contribution to the genre.
So the book opens with an account of the destruction of the Abu Zubaydah interrogation tapes. For those readers who have not read the book, this is not a book that shies away from controversy. And you kind of dive right into it. The implication is that at some level, that incident is emblematic of a larger pattern. The larger pattern being, I take it that the agency is asked to do things that the political system then will not take responsibility for having asked it to do, and that it then has to adjust to the certainty of exposure and whiplash. And I'm interested in your account of that problem, which I take it to be inherent in this idea that the agency is destined to be embroiled in scandal.
Yeah, I led off the book with it. I mean, actually, for a couple of reasons. It is the destruction of the so-called torture videotapes, so it's still reasonably fresh in certainly people's minds who follow this national security issues and CIA issues. So I thought it would be a way to to show immediately to the reader what you just described, Ben, that phenomenon, and also the role. I was chief legal counsel at the time. The role the lawyer plays at CIA, which is to basically jump into the middle of these brewing or even incipient controversies, and become, for better or worse, immersed in all of the details and immersed in the fallout once the inevitable flap hits. I also used it, frankly, I mean, quite honest, as, you know, sometimes the CIA is sometimes its own worst enemy, the way it handles some of these controversies. And that's, you know, that's part of the legacy of CIA as well. So it was a combination of all those reasons.
This issue is still going on. I mean, you know, not the destruction of tapes issue, but right now the Senate Select Committee is, you know, but locking horns with the director over the release of this report, as well as the substance of this report. 12 years after the fact, 10 years after the fact, 6 years after the program ends, when does the controversy over this program end? What does it take for us to reach some kind of settlement of the question of whether the CIA did the right thing or the wrong thing, and how much of the wrong thing in the context of post-9/11 interrogation stuff?
Yeah, it is remarkable, isn't it, the seeming durability of this subject.
I mean, just sorry to interrupt. We are sitting here at Pepperdine Law School, where you're going to give a speech this afternoon, and there are security people walking all over this building because the Code Pink people have threatened to disrupt the talk. Right? I mean, there's some sense in which this is all very much still live, and I'm curious just what you make of it, and what's the point where we get to some kind of institutional resolution?
Yeah, I will admit, I mean, from the beginning, I knew this program was going to be controversial. I knew that before it started, that we went down that road. Sooner or later, this would become a huge issue. I did not imagine that it would remain such a third rail in American national security and just straight out politics 5 years after the program was unequivocally and publicly ended. I mean, just last year, of course, the movie Zero Dark Thirty came out. And, you know, you'll remember the reaction to all that. The depiction of the interrogation scenes in that film sparked, once again, this furious emotional debate, certainly in Washington, about the morality and efficacy of the program. I mean, it has had remarkable legs. I mean, I have no doubt, Ben, that what the first paragraph of my obituary will read, John Rizzo, who approved a controversial CIA program post 9/11 to interrogate suspects that programs that some many observers remarked as tortured, died today. I mean,
are you comfortable with that?
Well, I'm resigned to it. You know, this is, for better or worse, is the extent, I mean, the reason I became a public figure after 25 years of being happily in the shadows as a CIA lawyer was because of this program. I mean, in all honesty, I don't think publishers would have been, frankly, interested in my memoir, which covers my entire career, were it not for my becoming this public figure so late in the career. So, and insofar as the reactions I've gotten when I'm out on speaking appearances, especially since, you know, the book came out, you know, I knew going in that there would be, you know, there would be occasional demonstrations, and I've met representatives of the Code Pink branch offices in New York and San Francisco prior to today. So, I mean, I accept it all. As I say, I wouldn't have predicted it, but it's something about this idea, this program, that still arouses such intense controversy. And arguments and counter-arguments and counter-charges and charges on both sides. And as you say, now we have this imbroglio over the Senate Intelligence Committee report.
Do you understand the degree of feeling that people still have about it, or is it sort of mystifying to you? I mean, you say you knew this was going to be radioactive from the beginning. The thing that surprises me about the controversy is not that we have an ongoing moral controversy over, you know, what can you and can't you do in the way of physical coercion of detainees without violating either some moral code or the text of any specific legal code. The thing that surprises me is that 12 years down the road, we have no factual agreement, apparently, even among the people most intimately familiar with the program, either from the CIA side or from the Senate side. And we have no factual agreement as to the contours either of, you know, what precisely was done or how effective what was done was, or who is lying about what aspects of it. And it seems like all of the basic factual information after all of this time is still entirely disputed.
Yeah. Well, of course, the techniques that were originally authorized that have been, of course, long since declassified in the so-called torture memos that were prepared by the Department of Justice at my request, and which, you know, lucky guy that I am, were all addressed to me personally. I mean, those are on the public record, have been on the public record for several years. But the other aspect of this that you mentioned, I think, is critical, which is the value of the program. You know, was it worth it? Did it produce results? Was it the sine qua non of foiling terrorist plots? I don't think that will ever be, frankly, resolved. Both sides, I think, have taken their positions. There are not going to be any other. I doubt the Senate report is going to settle that issue, because obviously, at least to me, from not having seen it, but it seems to be coming at the subject from a definite, in my view, preconceived angle that the whole program was basically useless. So that's the, I mean, that's the MacGuffin of all this. And you know, put another way, could the same results derived from the interrogation program, could they have been obtained from high-level detainees without having to resort to ever, by any measure, brutal tactics? And, you know, I think that is, I mean, that is unknowable. I mean, I'm not prepared to say that absolutely it would have been impossible to get any information out of these guys without the program. But to my mind, the key thing I think people need to keep in mind is the context of the times. I mean, how long in 2002, how long would it have taken to get the same information out of Zubeda and a few months later, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, using normal FBI style interrogation techniques? Perhaps it would have come. But when? I mean, these guys weren't in the mood to just start coughing up information. And time was the one thing we had in those first months and year after 9/11. Time was one thing we didn't have because the fear was pervasive that another attack could be right around the corner.
So when you look back on it, and I then want to go way back to the larger narrative arc of your book, but when you look back on it, what do you think were the CIA's big mistakes in the program? What do you think were your mistakes in advising the agency? And how much of it do you think was just the inevitable arc that the CIA would be ordered to be aggressive, and then would take the whiplash when society second-guessed itself?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, one of the themes of the book is the idea of the political pendulum always swinging at CIA, seemingly in the wrong direction at any given time, lopping off our heads. As you recall, in the immediate wake of the 9/11 attacks, the opprobrium was intense and bipartisan on Capitol Hill, and in the media, that CIA in the years pre-9/11, in the run of 9/11, was risk-averse. Wasn't aggressive enough, wasn't imaginative enough to have the guts, frankly, to take risks and to aggressively infiltrate Al Qaeda and therefore find out about 9/11 and deter it. So that was the drum roll with. You know, inevitably, as the years went on and there was no second wave of attacks, the mantra shifted from protect us at all costs to, well, you know, what have you guys been up to anyway? And that was inevitable. In terms of my mistakes, I'm sure I made mistakes. I mean, my biggest regret and my biggest mistake about 9/11, the reaction to 9/11, how we handled the interrogation program specifically, is that, you know, the White House at the outset insisted that the knowledge about the interrogation program, about the techniques, be limited to the so-called Gang of Eight, the leadership of the Congress. I mean, that was a White House call. It was, as you know, under the law, it's a call the president can make. But I think that was a grievous mistake, and I hold myself partially responsible for that because we could have pushed back. I could have pushed back. You know, I'd been at the agency long enough, as I say, I knew that this thing was going to be politically toxic at some point. I should have pushed back much harder to insist much earlier that, at a minimum, the full membership of the intelligence committees had to be briefed, not on these, you know, sporadic sessions that we had with the Gang of Eight off the record, but, you know, full committee hearings, transcripts, the whole nine yards. And therefore, and by that way, at least have a document, undisputed record, that the committees knew about these techniques, that they either approved of them, or if you know, they were as appalled by them as they years later claimed to be, go on the record and say that and cut off the money for them. But as a result, we have this ambiguity now. And we have the, as I say, the political consensus crumbled, and we were left exposed. So that, more than anything else, is the biggest mistake I think I made in terms of trying to look ahead to see what would be the best way to ensure some sort of consensus one way or the other about this program.
One of the oddities of this whole debate over a long time, partly because tough measures are associated with conservatives, and partly because it was the Bush administration that did this stuff, is that the program is almost entirely defended in the public arena by conservatives, and it is pretty uniformly reviled by liberals. It's one of the most politically and in a partisan sense divisive of the war on terror issues, in contrast, say, to drone strikes, right, which have critics and defenders in both political movements. And the result is that, you know, you're sort of listed constantly among, you know, Dick Cheney, David Addington, John Yoo, right, people who are sort of, you know, have very strongly ideological views. But you're a career guy who kind of worked for the agency and administrations of both parties. What are your basic political commitments? Like, who are you as a political animal?
Well, I was born and raised in Massachusetts. I've lived in Washington, D.C. since 1972, neither of which are hardly Republican bastions. I grew up as a Kennedy Democrat. I still to this day believe that the death of Robert Kennedy was, you know, one can quantify these things, the greatest political tragedy in my formative years for the country. He's still my political hero. You know, since 1972, I've been registered as an independent. And as you pointed out, I never considered myself a political guy. I joined the CIA in 1975, worked under seven presidents of both political parties. I voted for Republicans for president and voted for Democrats for president. So you're right, I found it somewhat bemused by being identified so late in my career with this, you know, with this, you know, I think largely admirable man, but still so lumped into this ideological conservative bin. I mean, I think part of that was attributed to the fact that I, you know, late in my career, I was nominated to the, you know, to be the permanent CIA General Counsel, and it was a presidential appointment. I was nominated by President Bush. And it was right in 2007 when the program was at its most contentious and controversial. And I was immediately viewed, certainly by all the Democrats on the Hill, as a Bush lieutenant, a Bush loyalist, which, you know, I never considered myself a Republican, certainly.
Has it forced you to acquire a political identification in your own mind that you didn't previously have? I mean, do you think now of one side as sort of your team in this regard and the other side as the opposing team, or have you kind of consciously resisted that?
Well, I mean, certainly in the foreign policy, national security arena, I mean, philosophically, I would clearly be aligned with the more conservative wing of the party. Of course, when the conservative wing of the Republican Party is a moving target, I don't know where Rand Paul fits on that spectrum, but sure, I'm probably there. You know, domestically, I think I'm still more aligned with the Democratic Party principles than I am the Republican Party principles. I mean, do you remember Scoop Jackson? The old idea of being a Scoop Jackson Democrat, very, you know, liberal in terms of the domestic side, but very hawkish on the foreign policy side. I guess that's roughly how I describe myself now.
So tell us how you came to be at the CIA and about sort of some of the larger narrative arc of the book, which actually, you know, tracks a lot of years and a lot of political disputes between the agency and Congress, about which you mostly through stories develop a thesis, right? So give us a sense of the larger story and the thesis that emerges from it.
Yeah, well, first of all, in terms of how I came to apply to CIA in the first place in 1975, you know, all I can best describe it as a shot in the dark. I didn't know I certainly didn't know anyone in CIA. I didn't know all that much about CIA. I mean, back in the mid-70s, CIA was still a relatively shrouded organization in terms of what was in the public record file. I joined because I was a young lawyer, a couple of years out of law school, a lawyer in the Treasury Department. My first job was a decent job, but, you know, I was young, ambitious. The bureaucracy of Treasury was stultifying, and I was restless. And this sense of restlessness coincided with the Church Committee hearings that were being telecast in large chunks on TV at the time. And this, as you will recall, was the first really public exposure of CIA actions, follies, misadventures, misdeeds in the 50s and 60s, the assassination plots and such. And like everyone else, I was watching these proceedings on television, being alternately, I guess, fascinated and repelled, thinking, well, I thought a couple of things. Was this what the CIA was really like? I mean, all I had to go on before that was with the James Bond movies and the pulp novels, neither of which I was an aficionado of, by the way. But the second reaction I had was, I don't even know if CIA is lawyers, but watching this, I have a feeling that if they don't, they're going to need some.
How many did they have?
They had, I did not know this at the time, obviously, but at the time of those hearings, there were 10 lawyers in the office, all of whom had been there a considerable amount of time, mostly in their early to mid-50s, had never worked anywhere else except at CIA. By the time I walked in the door, a year later, approximately after all the security processing, I was the 16th lawyer hired. What I didn't realize, maybe the 17th, what I didn't realize when I walked in the door is that 6 months or a year before, there only had been 10, and that I was, in effect, the first wave of so-called new blood that CIA was going to bring into the legal office.
So by the time you left, how many lawyers were in the GC's office?
There were 125, and I suspect that number is probably closer to 150, 160. So, I mean, it's remarkable. And that was one of the things I wanted to capture in the book, that it's remarkable about the proliferation of lawyers in CIA during the exponential increase during the course of my career. And also, frankly, the fact that all those lawyers still can't seem to keep CIA from getting itself into pickles from time to time.
And why is that? So let's go to that sort of larger thesis. Why is there this recurrent cycle in which the CIA, no matter how many lawyers it has, can't stay out of trouble?
Well, you know,
there are these agencies that and when DOD has, you know, occasional big problems with Congress, but it's over giant hierarch policy questions like, should we invade Iraq, right? Which are really presidential questions, not agency level questions. The day-to-day fabric of the relationship between DOD and the Congress is not a cycle of, action, goaded action and then recrimination. What is it about CIA that creates that cycle?
Well, goaded action is actually a nice, pithy way of putting it. CIA You know, CIA is a pointy spear of the national security and foreign policy establishment. It is now and has always been at the just complete discretion of whatever president of whatever party happened to be sitting at the Oval Office at the time. My experience was there were seven during my time at CIA, is that sooner or later they turned to CIA. Because CIA can do things in secret, they can do things the president wants CIA to do, they can do it in a way that they can carry it out not only undercover, but in a way that goes around, that does not have to be subjected to normal appropriations process or even congressional review. There are intelligence committees, but it's a limited. So it's a very seductive tool. And when presidents find themselves facing foreign policy crises, for instance, going back to President Carter, he was confronted with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1980. He was confronted with the takeover of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. Their first inclination is to turn to CIA. President Reagan, his successor, was confronted with the increasing Soviet and Cuban influence in Central America, the Sandinista regime. So what do? They authorized CIA to undertake not intelligence collection missions, which is sort of in the institutional DNA of CIA, and for which there's largely been a consensus, but these covert action programs, these stealthy, messy, long-running secret programs that, you know, for any number of reasons, tend to blow up one way or the other, and there are always repercussions. And you know, CIA just seems inevitably to get sucked into one of these things. Sometimes, you know, sometimes through no fault of its own, and sometimes over the years, frankly, because they screw something up.
So what's an example of a case where it gets sucked in through no fault of its own? And what's an example of a case where, you know, it's a complete unforced error, self-inflicted wound sort of thing?
Well, the second category is probably easier for me, because that's really where lawyers have to come to the fore. The Iran-Contra affair. That was the CIA director at the time, this unforgettable character named William Casey, in many ways the smartest CIA director I ever served under, but also a bit of a cowboy, a buccaneer. He involved the agency in this initiative, covert initiative, working closely with Oliver North in the NSC, to this scheme to secretly ship arms to the Iranians in a way that was intended to ultimately influence and facilitate the release of the U.S. hostages that were being held with increasing frequency in the early to mid 80s in Lebanon, and then compounding that by using the proceeds from those arms sales to secretly divert funds to support the Contras in Nicaragua, an action that was expressly forbidden by Congress at the time. Now, to my mind, I was mercifully lucky about many things in my career. Mercifully, I had taken a respite from my normal job of overseeing covert operations for that year of 1985. So I missed all of that. So I just think that was the agency, you know, totally shooting itself in the foot. In terms of actions the CIA was directed to do that became toxic through no fault of its own, you know, I think in some respects the initial program at lunch by President Carter, and then certainly the ante was up considerably by President Reagan when he came in, about funding the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. The idea was to repel the Soviet occupation, get the Soviets out of Afghanistan. You know, that in the short term was successful, and one of the agency's historically, you know, more skillfully carried out campaigns. On the other hand, it produced a whole generation of Mujahideen who, once the Soviets were out, turned their attention to the U.S. against the U.S., including a very young fellow named Osama bin Laden. And the agency was blamed for sort of, you know, perversely enough, for being, it was one of the gripes after 9/11 that we had created al-Qaeda by our support to the Mujahideen 10 years earlier. So
which was the interrogation program? Was this a situation where the CIA, you know, the attraction of the CIA as the pointy spear for a president was, you know, so great that the agency was simply ordered and directed to do things that got it into trouble? Or is this a situation of a self-inflicted wound that the agency was sort of eager to do things that then got it into trouble and kind of blundered its own way into it?
Well, you know, in fairness, basically it was a little bit of both. In fairness, the interrogation program, the idea of it did not start in the White House. It started in CIA, in the Counterterrorism Center. So the idea germinated in CIA. So we came up with the idea that these techniques were inevitable. They were the only thing that would elicit the information we needed from these high-level detainees to avert another attack. But on the macro level, of course, the White House and I must say Congress had made it clear to CIA that they were to pull out all the stops in the post 9/11 era. Basically, do whatever it took. The idea was to repel what everyone thought was another catastrophic attack around the corner, and basically gave the CIA carte blanche. I mean, to this day, Ben, I don't consider the program for all the controversies caused for all the, you know, frankly, damage that the agency institutionally has taken for it. I don't sit here today and consider it to have been a blunder or a feckless exercise.
So what is the right posture, given that history and all the history that you've watched, when a president says, failure is unacceptable, do everything lawfully at your disposal to prevent X? And there is a gap between what you're doing and what you as a lawyer think is lawfully available. But you know that in that gap lies enormous controversy. Is the right answer for the agency, as you just described, to say, well, okay, what is the list of techniques that we can defend as lawful that we're not currently using? Or is the right answer to say, hey, we have to protect ourselves in the long run from the backlash that we know is coming, and, you know, we should add to the White House's direction and institutionally long-term defensible as a criterion? Like, what's the right direction when you get a direction like that? How should you think about it?
Well, that's the conundrum, isn't it? You know, clearly I took the first route, which was to not stop the program before it started, which I believe I could have done, but to seek guidance about the techniques that were being proposed, first and foremost, to whether or not, you know, they were lawful under U.S. law. That was the entire reason why I went to the Office of Legal Counsel. As I said earlier, I knew deep down that sooner or later this program was going to suck the agency into immense controversy. By the way, you know, that would, if there had been a second attack, mercifully there hadn't been, but if there had been a second attack, and when those list of techniques were discovered and exposed in the aftermath, I challenge anyone to assert that the same program would have been directed, namely that the program was too brutal, too tough.
Oh, no, everybody would have focused on the ones that you didn't approve,
yeah.
The bug in the small box, and
yeah, So I mean, it was a no-win situation. I mean, I just knew we were going to, you know, one way or the other, we were going to pay for this politically. But, you know, as a lawyer at CIA, and of course I was a chief lawyer, so the buck stopped with me, I thought, you know, and I still do, my two chief responsibilities. One is to ensure the agency activities are lawful under U.S. law, but two, advance the mission, and in this case, protect the country, and allow agency people to do what they think is necessary to achieve those two ends.
There is an agency right now that is experiencing exactly the pattern that you describe for the CIA, but it's not the CIA, it's NSA, right? Do much more, do everything you can, lean forward. We're shocked that you're surveilling lots of people. And I'm interested for your thoughts on what NSA has been through over the last 9 months. They have, since the period of the Church Commission, managed to keep their heads down while you guys have really been taking the flak for all kinds of scandals. Now they're kind of in the front lines. What do you make of it?
Well, I mean, I will confess to there's a certain part of this that shows me to be perhaps petty and cynical, but I always, all those years at CIA when I was, you know, in the middle of some firestorm or another that CIA, you know, had gotten itself into or had been foisted upon CIA, I always had this grudging respect and envy for NSA, which was a much larger agency with a lot more money, but yet, as you say, it was basically operating without a blip on the political or legal radar screen. I found that remarkable and admirable in many ways. I think the way the NSA handled this, I mean, the Snowden business when it first started, I think it betrayed a certain extent the unfamiliar territory NSA was in at this point. This political, this open public political firestorm. And you know, I think they had to learn as they went along. I think some of the initial steps were not politically nimble, frankly. Some of the appearances senior NSA officials and made on Capitol Hill backfired. I think they were caught on their heels. But, you know, now we're 7 or 8 months into it, and, you know, much like CIA, after the initial burst and the initial criticism and media exposures and all of that, I think NSA is beginning to get its footing now and doing what they should be doing, proposing legislative and administrative reforms to try to address and mollify the adverse publicity and criticism it's getting.
So a lot of people in your book come off as hypocrites, people who drive the cycle that you describe. I'm curious. Last question, end on an upbeat note. Who were the people over this 30-year career at the political level, 35-year career at the political level, whom you came away with really admiring for not playing into that cycle and for being, for urging the same activity prospectively that they turned out then to be willing to defend retrospectively?
Well, the intelligence committees, you know, I lived with various incarnations of the intelligence committees for over three decades. And, you know, back in the Halcyon days of the 80s, in the early 90s, the committees were populated, especially the Senate Intelligence Committee, by these really bipartisan giants, men like John Glenn and David Bourne and Barry Goldwater, John Warner, Sam Nunn. I mean, the list goes on. They were both Republicans and Democrats. And, you know, when the agency screwed up, the criticism tended to be bipartisan and, in most cases, deserved. And that was actually, to us at the agency, reassuring. I mean, you know, the one thing we could expect was sort of fair, non-apolitical treatment. You know, we've lost that in the last 10 years since 9/11. Everything now is viewed in a partisan prism. Is there hope for the future? I tend to think so. CI is a resilient organization. In terms of people I really respect, and getting away from the Capitol Hill side, but, you know, my last CI director was Leon Panetta. I only worked for him for about 8 or 9 months, which was 8 or 9 months longer than I thought I would be kept on. To my amazement, when the Obama administration came in, he asked me to stay. And he was, of course, a lifelong Democrat. He had made no secret that one of the first words out of his mouth in his confirmation hearing is they viewed the program, the CI program, as torture. But as soon as he came on board, partly because he was a savvy politician, partly, I think, frankly, just because of the kind of guy he was, he went out of his way to protect and defend the agency, for instance, fighting against the public release of the OLC memos, when he had no conceivable reason, frankly, or benefit to him for doing so, simply because he thought it wasn't the right thing to do. And that was, I found that immensely admirable and courageous on his part. So as long as we have leaders, future leaders, with the kind of stuff that Leon Panetta has, then I think there's reason for optimism.
Thanks for joining us, John. Good luck with the book. Good luck with Confronting Code Pink today. Join us again.
Thank you, Ben.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Gregory McNeil and the folks at Pepperdine University Law School for facilitating the conversation with Rizzo. Our music, as always, is performed by Sophia Yan. I would be remiss if I didn't remind you to review, rate, and share the Lawfare podcast by whatever means are available to you to do so. It's important, guys. Spread the word. Make a nuisance of yourselves. Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.